Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, we meet the portrait painter of the popes. She's a Russian artist with a big dream to become the Vatican's next Michelangelo. But first, Jill Bevilacqua reflects on this Sunday's Gospel reading in her program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus entered a village where a woman named Martha welcomed him to her home. She had a sister named Mary, who seated herself at the Lord's feet and listened to his words. Martha, who was busy with all the details of hospitality, came to him and said, "Lord, are you not concerned that my sister has left me all alone to do the household tasks? Tell her to help me." The Lord, in reply, said to her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and upset about many things. One thing only is required. Mary has chosen the better portion, and she shall not be deprived of it."
No mention is made of its name, only a village. But a village which is dear to every Christian, because it was dear to Christ. Bethany, or as today's guidebook writes, Al-Azariyeh, an Arabic version of the name of Lazarus, the most famous inhabitant of the village. Today's gospel is not concerned with Lazarus, but with his sisters, Martha and Mary, in a celebrated episode, frequently quoted for the unexpected answer Jesus gives to Martha. It's autumn, probably sometime in October, and the Feast of Tabernacles is imminent. Last week we heard the parable of the Good Samaritan and the account of a traveller's journey down the desert road from Jerusalem to Jericho. Jesus and the disciples are travelling in the opposite direction, up towards Jerusalem. And as we read in other versions of today's Gospel, in the course of their journey he came to a village. The village was Bethany. It is, we read in the guidebook,
a village on the lower eastern slope of the Mount of Olives, nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off, quoting an old version of John, on the Jerusalem-Jericho road. The name Bethany derives from the Greek form of the Hebrew Beth Ananiah, the house of a person named Ananiah, or the shortened version Bethaniah. The site does not seem to have been inhabited prior to the 6th century BC. From that time on, Bethany has been continuously settled and was, as it is now, the last stop on the Jericho road before entering Jerusalem.
When H.V. Morton drove down that road from Jerusalem, he noted that the first sign of life was a well, known as the Fountain of the Apostles. But he mentioned something else.
On my right, a narrow footpath ran back through the hills to Jerusalem. This was the ancient shortcut to Bethany, and the road that Jesus and his disciples would have taken when they went up to the Passover and the Last Supper.
The Jericho road also sends a branch road right up over the crest of the Mount of Olives to Bethphage and Bethany. And on another occasion, our traveller walked this road with, as he writes, the sun beating on it and the heat quivering like white fire on the rocks. Which road did Jesus and the disciples take, I wonder? Did they know the shortcut? Did they already know Martha and Mary? And where did the disciples stay while Jesus was there? It seems they would have had no problem in finding lodgings, for according to the Talmud, Bethany and its neighbour Bethphage were specially noted for their hospitality to pilgrims. On this occasion, when the Feast of Tabernacles was so near, pilgrims would already be converging on Jerusalem, so the two villages would be in readiness for the expected influx. Bethphage seems to have disappeared from the map, for the guidebook tells us that the name now applies to a Franciscan church, built next to the very steep road that descends from the Mount of Olives eastwards towards the village of El Azariyeh, ancient Bethany, and the Jerusalem-Jericho highway. But we will remember Bethphage for the errand on which Jesus sent two disciples, as Matthew recounts.
When they were near Jerusalem and had come in sight of Bethphage on the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village facing you, and you will immediately find a tethered donkey and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me."
Mark adds that the tethered colt had not yet been ridden by anyone. An invisible reserved was on its back. We are not in Bethphage, however, but in Bethany, and there's an atmosphere of festivity in the village on the little hill. The Feast of Tabernacles was one of the three so-called pilgrim or foot festivals, because pilgrims travel to Jerusalem to celebrate them in the temple. All three have in common the theme of joy in God's presence, writes modern Jewish scholar Norman Solomon.
The festive joy is traditionally expressed in feasting with meat and drink, and with the purchase of new garments for the women. It's a joy which is only complete when allied with concern for the needy. Each of the festivals has a historical, a spiritual, and an agricultural meaning.
So writes Solomon, and in a table explains these: Sukkot, Tabernacles, Autumn. The historical meaning: God protected the Israelites in the desert, and he quotes Leviticus.
"So that your generations should know that I made the Israelites dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt."
The spiritual meaning: God is our protector. This is symbolised as we leave our homes and dwell in simple booths, Sukkot. The agricultural meaning: the final harvest festival of the year. A manual on daily life in Bible times goes into more detail about the festival, known also as the Feast of Booths, because the Israelites lived in tents or arbours during the celebration.
The festival began on the 15th day of the 7th month, Tishri, and lasted for 7 days. It fell at the end of the harvest season, thus a third name for the festival, the Feast of Ingathering. The priests offered a special burnt offering of 70 bullocks during the week. 2 rams and 14 lambs were the daily burnt offering, and a male goat the daily sin offering. Every 7th year, when there was no harvest because of the sabbatical year, the law of Moses was read publicly during the feast.
We don't know if the women went up to the temple for the feast, but as the manual explains,
all males were required to appear before the sanctuary of the Lord during Israel's great pilgrim feasts.
And we don't know whether Jesus and the apostles participated in all of the Jewish rituals and feasts. Jesus loved the temple and respected it. He supported it by encouraging his followers to attend it. Yet Jesus said that in this place is one greater than the temple, referring to himself. In John's Gospel, we read that as the Feast of Tabernacles drew near, his relations urged Jesus to leave Galilee and go to Judea so that his disciples there could see the works he was doing. But Jesus answered them,
"The right time for me has not come yet, but any time is the right time for you. Go up to the festival yourselves. I'm not going to this festival because for me the time is not ripe yet." Having said that, he stayed behind in Galilee.
As we are following Luke's Gospel, we know that Jesus did indeed leave Galilee and go towards Jerusalem. And John goes on,
"However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went up as well, but quite privately, without drawing attention to himself. At the festival, the Jews were on the lookout for him. 'Where is he?' they said. When the festival was half over, Jesus went to the temple and began to teach."
So it sounds as if the journey to Jerusalem Jesus made was with the apostles and close disciples, but that he preferred to let his relations go on ahead, to avoid the clamour they seem so often to have roused with their criticisms of his behaviour. And so here he is, sitting quietly in Bethany, having left his companions to go over to Jerusalem, a couple of miles away, to fulfil their temple duties. Perhaps Lazarus is with them. His sisters, however, are at home. And as Norman Solomon comments, festival celebrations are as much a matter for the home as for the synagogue. Solomon is writing today, when the temple is no more and the synagogue is the centre of Jewish worship. Let's hear how H.V. Morton imagines the scene at Bethany that day so long ago.
Sitting on the little hill above Bethany, I could visualize the scene. The house with the smell of cooking around it for the Feast of Tabernacles, at which this incident occurred, was a busy time for Jewish women, and the little arbor of green leaves, the tabernacle of the feast, beneath which Jesus would be sitting in the courtyard with Mary at his feet. They would both be able to see and hear Martha, busy with her pots and pans, and she would see Jesus and Mary so cool and idle while she was so busy. How well her irritation is conveyed by the fact that she includes Jesus in her rebuke. "Lord, do you not care that my sister is leaving me to do all the serving by myself? Please tell her to help me." She might have said, "Lord, see how my sister is leaving me to serve alone." But she is too angry. If they'd been invisible from her kitchen, she might not have been so angry. She would not have seen her sister so cool and tidy, so calm and so intelligent. But Jesus and Mary were sitting in the courtyard, in a leafy summer house of fresh boughs, the peace that surrounded them and the shade in which they sat, throwing into relief her own labours, quickening her self-pity and her sense of injustice. As Martha stands before Jesus, we know her so well. She is immortal and international. In every language under the sun and in every age, Martha has broken into a discussion with an indignant, "You sit there doing nothing while I'm working my fingers to the bone." And the reply she receives from the arbor is enough to bring tears to her eyes. "Martha," says Jesus, mentioning her name twice, and thus putting great affection into what followed. "Martha, Martha, you worry and fret about so many things, and yet few are needed, indeed only one. It is Mary who's chosen the better part. It's not to be taken from her."
Luke's account ends here, a mere 100 words, but so dense with meaning that no more words are needed. Silence is the only possible sequel. And silence is what one imagines followed those words of our Lord. What did Martha do? Standing at the kitchen door, holding one of those pots or pans, she puts it down and throws herself at the feet of the Master. Behind her, a bubbling or sizzling warns her that she must go and see that nothing is burning. But she takes no notice. If it burns, what does it matter? Nothing matters but to be with him.
Artists today can aspire to the kind of greatness that opened the doors of the Vatican to such masters as Michelangelo, Raphael, and Bernini. But there is one young woman who dares to dream that one day her name will be added to the list of unforgettable artists whose works adorn such places as the Papal Apartments, the Pauline Chapel, and the Vatican Museums. Masterpieces to be cherished and studied for centuries to come.
In realtà ho cominciato a disegnare prestissimo, praticamente prima di imparare a camminare.
I began painting when I was just a little girl, practically before I even learned to walk. My mother understood this was my calling, and so when I was 5 years old, she enrolled me in a special school of design. I was 1 year younger than the rest of the children. When I was 11, I succeeded in getting into one of the best art schools in Moscow. There, I was able to really expand on my passion and improve my drawing and painting skills. It helped me get into Moscow's Academy of Fine Arts, an extremely difficult school to get into.
All'Accademia di Belle Arti, perché la scuola era abbastanza forte.
Natalia Tsarkova grew up in Moscow in the Soviet era and witnessed the dawning of perestroika and the fall of the Berlin Wall.
È fondamentale avere avanti dell'età di bambina avanti questo esempio dell'artista.
From the time I was a child, it was fundamental to me to look to the great masters as examples. Artists such as Michelangelo, Caravaggio and Velázquez, but also the Russian school of the 1800s called Передвижника. This period, too, was very important for me.
Under a communism that obliterated the faith, churches were destroyed and Bibles were banned. It might be something of a miracle that Bibles were a permitted textbook at the Moscow Academy of Fine Arts where Natalia studied. But then again, the gospel stories and iconography of the Bible are the very things that have inspired some of the world's greatest artists for more than 2,000 years.
Ho sempre provato una forte attrazione per l'arte sacra.
I have always felt a strong attraction to sacred art, ever since I was a child when I went to art school. Reading the Bible, for example, was even part of our study program. I believe that it was this charismatic presence of the Lord which pointed me in this direction. As His Holiness Pope John Paul II said in his letter to artists, the Church needs art to render visible the invisible, the world of the Spirit, of God. And I too heard this call.
Anche io ho sentito questo richiamo.
A petite blonde with rosy cheeks and an angelic smile, Natalia could easily be mistaken for one of the ephemeral cherubs in her compositions. But don't be fooled by her appearance. This little lady is well on her way to realizing one big dream, not just of being the first woman to paint the official portraits of the popes, but ultimately to be the first woman to paint something as grand as the Sistine Chapel.
Natalia Tsarkova is not only artistically gifted, but also she has a great vision of these stories. She thinks a great deal upon the holy stories before she paints them. She gets to understand her subject before she does a portrait. And so if I were to be decorating a large-scale chapel or putting in a new refectory painting, Natalia Tsarkova would be the first person I thought of.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University and is a regular guest on Vatican Radio.
Natalia's already had some experience with doing larger format paintings in which she has to find a new 21st century way of treating an iconographical subject, which is 700, 800, 1,000 years old. And I think what's even more interesting in her body of work is that she has also had the opportunity to create an iconography and something that she has done, again, splendidly well.
Natalia was the first woman to study at Moscow's prestigious Academy of Fine Arts and the first to graduate. I asked her what women can contribute to the arts that sets them apart from their male colleagues.
In realtà io sono stata per un periodo l'unica donna a frequentare l'Accademia.
Well, for a period I was the only woman student at the Academy because it was extremely rare that a woman be admitted. In that period, for example, my maestro would say that a woman's place was in the home, with family.
Young boys at the academy used to come up to Natalia and tease her. "Why are you here?" they'd ask. "You won't have time to paint when you're married and having kids."
Penso che, almeno per la mia esperienza, le donne possono contribuire all'arte.
I think that, at least in my experience, women can contribute to art through communicating a different sensitivity, perhaps even a different energy. And this is because women have had to work hard to emerge in a world dominated by men, and it's not easy for women.
E spesso resa difficile per le donne.
It wasn't easy for Natalia to leave her family and her home to come to Italy in 1994. But it didn't take her long to earn a name for herself as a portrait painter for the Roman nobility. And then came her biggest commission ever.
La voce si è sparsa ed è arrivata fino al Vaticano.
Word got around and even got to the Vatican, which summoned me and commissioned me to paint the portrait of Pope John Paul II. The result was judged to be excellent, and the painting became the official portrait of the Pope. Later, I carried out another four portraits of Pope Wojtyła. One is in Washington at the John Paul II Cultural Center. Another was donated by Cardinal Stanislaw Dziewicz to the Basilica of Santa Maria del Popolo here in Rome. And the other two are on display in Detroit, Michigan. Then I was commissioned to do the official portrait of Pope John Paul I, and then the one of Pope Benedict XVI.
Natalia Tsarkova has since become the official portrait artist of the popes and of many Vatican officials. She's the first woman ever to have the job.
Posso dire che è stato la realizzazione di un mio sogno.
I can say that this has been one of my dreams come true. I continue to thank the Lord for having given me this possibility. It's also a big responsibility and a great honor of which I am proud.
Quale vado fiera.
Natalia, you also met Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict. Tell me about your meetings with them and what did they have to say to you?
Io ho avuto questo onore di avere audienza privata.
Yes, I had the honor of meeting them in private audience. This was a very moving and beautiful experience for me. Something very special happened when I presented my first official portrait of Pope John Paul II to him.
Lui mi ha detto in russo. Ha detto in russo, sì, che sono stata molto sorpresa.
He told me in Russian. Yes, Russian. I was very surprised at that. I didn't know the Holy Father spoke Russian well, but he said this to me. You're Russian. Long live Russian art. Continue as you're doing. And so I have been continuing, as he said, up to this day. More than 15 years have already gone by, and I have painted the portrait now of my third pope. I'm very happy.
Using brushstrokes similar to Velázquez, Natalia possesses an uncanny ability to enter into her subject's very soul. From a moistened eye to a furrowed brow to a tentative smile, Natalia unveils the very intimate side of her subjects. It's like we're standing in the very same room.
Much like Leonardo da Vinci in his forays into portraiture, played a complex game of drawing out the psychology, the personality, the inner depths of the sitter, and always making us aware of the tension that the sitter tries to disguise certain aspects of his or her person. Natalia removes that tension, that barrier, and opens up to us a facet of her sitter that's a little bit unexpected. So in a figure that we see as very formal or very business oriented, we see an interest in culture. In an iconic figure, we get something homey and comfortable. And so she throws in these wonderful little facets that her observations give us about a sitter.
But how can she paint the portrait of someone like Pope John Paul I, John Paul II's predecessor, so long after he had died and still make him so alive? I wondered. I discovered that like everything she does, Natalia doesn't leave much up to chance, just to divine providence, which she says often guides her brush. To prepare for her job, she studies the writings, photographs, and videos of her subjects, investigates their lives, their hobbies, passions, and their favorite things. As she painted John Paul I, Natalia filled her studio with the sound of the Pope's voice, as he read a homily or pronounced a special discourse. She submerges herself in the personality of the person she's painting, and the results are, oh, so tangible.
Art historian Kenneth Clark, a long time ago, tried to describe for us in a very small book what is a masterpiece. And he encapsulated a masterpiece in few words, something that draws together the past, the great historical tradition, but again, takes that tradition and projects it into the future. And that is what Natalia Tsarkova does. And that is the way the church has always commissioned art, taken artists who have a sense of the long tradition of the church, because the church is about tradition. And so the idea of an artist who understands that he or she is part of a long line of contributors to the culture of the church, but then that individual genius of that individual moment in time helps to project the images towards the future. So Natalia very much represents exactly what the church has always done in commissioning church art, and is a very good model for our day of how to continue to commission church art.
Though she studied her subject for more than a year before she put paint to canvas, it only took Natalia 3 months to paint her portrait of Benedict XVI. In the composition, Natalia has placed the Holy Father sitting on an ornately carved wooden chair, an antique throne, she calls it, full of symbolism, an inherent aspect of all her works.
Il Santo Padre è rimasto molto contento.
The Holy Father was very pleased. There are symbolic objects in it, and the Holy Father really appreciated these. Symbolism is fundamental in this painting. The color, the positioning, the background, everything is important because it points to a deeper meaning and message. For example, in the painting of Pope Benedict XVI, the Holy Father is sitting on a throne, and this throne really exists. It's the throne of Pope Leo XIII, and it's full of rich symbolism, carved angels and the dove symbolizing the Holy Spirit. When I saw this throne, I knew absolutely that the Holy Father had to sit on this throne. Later, I discovered the Holy Father loves this throne very much. So for me, this holds very special meaning.
Invece nel quadro, lo Spirito Santo illumina il Papa.
In the painting, the Holy Spirit shines down on the Pope. Its light illuminates the Holy Father and the angels come to life. One angel, whose eyes are alive, looks in the direction of the Pope. The Pope draws back his mantle with one hand and reveals the other angel, who takes on new life, looking towards us, engaging those of us in this world. The Holy Father is dressed in red robes, red, the symbol of love and faith. He's also holding a manuscript of his discourses and homilies, also very symbolic. It's a symbol of peace, because it's only through dialogue that peace can truly be achieved.
Is Natalia Tsarkova another Michelangelo just begging to release a torrent of fabulously fresh ideas and an unparalleled mastery of the brush? Can she challenge the 21st century's godless man to appreciate God's great plan for all mankind? I don't know, but she sure is off to one heck of a start.
Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.